This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4, where true crime meets history with a twist. This time, we're investigating an allegation of matricide, a daughter accused of murdering her own mother.
She has lived too long and has kept me out of my money till the hairs of my head are got grey.
I have seen the daughter beat her mother. The old woman was incapable of defending herself.
Kitty! Kitty, don't! Is she dead?
Yes.
I am as happy as if I was in heaven.
This is Lady Killers, where we re-examine the wild and unthinkable crimes of women from more than 100 years ago, where ordinary women committed extraordinary acts. We hear their voices, their words, and ask, did they do it? How did they do it? And why did they do it? And we ask, is life so very different for women today? It's deepest winter, 1848. We're in the market town of Bridgnorth, Shropshire, where work and fortunes ebb and flow along the River Severn it sits upon. On this particular night, the river's in flood. In the early hours at Mr. Dyer's house, one of his domestic servants, called Mary Caulfield, makes a grisly discovery. The body of an elderly lady, Anne Newton. The death looks highly suspicious. The poor woman's corpse has been horribly burnt. The local police officer, Richard Evans, arrests the dead woman's daughter, another servant, Kitty Newton, on the spot. Today on Lady Killers, we explore, is Kitty Newton guilty of this terrible act? Could a daughter really kill her very own mother? And if so, why? One thing seems certain, that there must be some skeletons hiding in this family's closet. Shall we get cracking? Luckily, I am joined by the wonderful crime writer Dorothy Coombson, who's known as the Queen of the Big Reveal. She's the author of The Ice Cream Girls, the bestseller adapted for TV, and more recently, Give Him to Me. She's known for her sharp insights into the tangled dynamics between mothers and daughters. Skills that'll come very much in handy here, I think. Welcome, Dorothy.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Dorothy, our setting has something of the Agatha Christie about it. There's the dark and stormy night, the market town. This is a close-knit community. Do you see the hallmarks of the thriller here?
Oh, absolutely. Even without all of that, it would be the kind of setting that you know is going to produce the sort of story that you're not expecting. There's going to be lots of twists. I can just imagine secrets that have come back to bite the people involved.
Do you always think of a sort of closed group of characters before you begin your work?
Oh, no. I usually think of a scenario. I'll overhear conversations. I eavesdrop a lot. So I hear people's conversations and I always take it to another level.
From real life conversations that you've overheard?
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that out loud, should I?
Well, you've got it in common with Agatha Christie, though, because she would sometimes get ideas for her stories by listening to people on the bus.
Me on the train or supermarket.
Ooh, I need to watch out for you. You're dangerous. Now, in your books, what draws you to the mother-daughter relationship?
I'm fascinated by relationships between people. One of the things about mother-daughter relationships, I think, is there's a lot of eulogising about how they're perfect and mothers and daughters bond all the time. And I don't believe that's the case. I like writing about them in the ways that they can go wrong, but they're always resolved in my books. That's not so much in real life, I don't think.
I'm going to come back for more from you. But in the meantime, this Kitty Newton who's been accused has a real name, which is Mercy, but she prefers Kitty, so we'll use it too. She works as a housekeeper for Mr. Dyer. He's an invalid, and Kitty is his pet name for her. She's a great favourite of the sickly Mr. Dyer. She's been in his service for 10 years. She's been running his house with authority and competence. Arriving at the crime scene, though, arresting officer Richard Evans finds a scene of chaos. There's been a suspicious fire in the kitchen. The sofa's half burnt. So are the pillows. The sheets are all wet, and in some oil on the floor, footprints are visible. And Newton's body is face down in the brew house, which is an outbuilding. Kitty is now frog marched to the town jail through the morning mist. But on the way, she says something curious.
This will be a Severn Hall job.
A Severn Hall job. What could that mean? We will find out later. But first of all, let's get to the scene of the crime in Bridgnorth, Shropshire, with our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to examine the clues.
Well, here I am in the bustling town of Bridgnorth, which is just to the west of Birmingham. To my right, there's a busy street of shops. And to my left, just over my shoulder, is Bridge Street, the bridge over the River Severn, the longest river in Great Britain. But in Victorian times, it would have been the river that was busy, because Bridgnorth was one of the most important inland ports in Britain. And it is this river that features so prominently in the records of this case. Walking away from town along the towpath, we get to the scene of the crime. And here we are at the house itself on the River Severn, where Kitty lives and works in 1848. It's quite an impressive building. It's several stories, it's a lovely red brick, and it's got a very impressive porch. At this time, in 1848, Kitty is 36 years old. She has one surviving parent, her mother, Anne Newton, who comes to visit her in this house often, and sometimes she even stays the night. We know from the records of this case that at about 2 a.m. in the morning, Kitty's fellow servant, Mary Caulfield, wakes to the sound of Mr. Dyer calling and the smell of smoke. She gets up, she runs downstairs and out to alert the neighbours. When she returns, she finds evidence of a fire in the kitchen. Mary claims that the previous evening, there had been a butter boat full of dripping, but now it was sitting on the hob, burned and empty. She also says that there was half a pint of oil sitting in the kitchen, but now the bottle is sitting on the fireplace and it's completely empty. It is fair to say that Victorian kitchens were a health and safety nightmare. Fire was always a possibility, especially when people were careless or doddery or intoxicated.
We've definitely got some clues in this kitchen. That oil or dripping might have fueled the fire, but the confusing thing is that Anne Newton's body isn't found in the kitchen. The body's in the brew house outside the property. Does this suggest foul play? Has the body been moved? Or might the fire have been a tragic accident, and might the elderly lady have been running away in this direction of the brew house? Let's think about the clues, Dorothy. So far, as clues, we've got the empty butter boat containing flammable dripping or butter. We've got a chaotic kitchen with wet bed sheets, and we've got this tense maternal relationship. Which clues stand out to you? What do you think we ought to be paying attention to?
The thing that stands out to me is the absence of sound, because if you are being burnt, you're going to be screaming the place down, and her screams would be absolutely heard throughout the house. So did it happen in the kitchen? Because there would be a lot of screaming and a lot of noise if someone was burnt to death there.
Absolutely. Yes, that hadn't occurred to me. That's a missing dimension from my image of the crime scene. How did it sound? A coroner's inquest into the death of Anne Newton is quickly arranged, and the news of the scandal spreads around the town. The first witness to take the stand is Mary, and her revelations about the fraught relationship between her colleague Kitty and her mother are eye-opening.
I have seen the daughter beat her mother. She also said she wished her mother was dead, and she would then drive a stake through her heart.
This acrimony between the mother and the daughter has gained momentum, fuelled by their fondness for whiskey.
Of late, she has been often intoxicated, and when so, she was more violent against her mother. I have seen her beat her more than half a dozen times. The old woman was incapable of defending herself.
Could this quarrelling have escalated to something more deadly? But hang on, that isn't quite the full picture. The local curate, the Reverend Marshall, takes to the stand, and he has a completely different perspective on Kitty.
My impression was that the daughter took a proper interest in the welfare of her mother.
And a townsman, Richard Bell, comes forward to say that Kitty was trying to improve her mother's accommodation.
The prisoner, Kitty, wished for her mother to be made comfortable and told me she would paper the room for her.
Dorothy, let's come to you. What are your first impressions of this Kitty Newton?
I think she's lived quite a hard life. You can just tell that she's been in a difficult situation for a lot of her life, I think. And getting this job seems to be a job that she loves and she enjoys. But she's always got her mother sort of hanging on, and she knows she's responsible for her mother as she gets older. I think she's probably got a lot of things going on.
What about this dichotomy in the views of her that the people in the town seem to have? Her fellow servant says she's awful and abuses her mother, yet other people like the curate say that she's a model daughter. She looks after her mum.
Well, what I noticed about that was that the women seem to dislike her, whereas the men seem to think she's a wonderful daughter and she was looking after her mother and wanting to improve her mother's life. People can be two things at once. Good people aren't good all the time. Bad people aren't bad all the time. Good people can do bad things. So absolutely, she can on one hand be raging at her mother, maybe beating her, and on the other hand, caring about her and worrying about her and wanting the best for her.
We are now heading back to Bridgnorth, where Roz is in the very courtroom where the inquest took place. And I think she might be about to drop a bombshell that could explain everything.
I'm at Bridgnorth Town Hall in Hightown on High Street. Now, in the 19th century, it would have been in the centre of the marketplace, and it still remains a very busy shopping area today. It sits quite high up above a covered marketplace surrounded with stone arches. But we are more interested in what happened inside that hall in 1848. I'm inside Bridgnorth Town Hall because this is where the inquest into the death of Anne Newton took place. Now, in the 19th century, all sudden, violent and unnatural deaths had to be reported to the coroner, who then decided whether it was necessary to hold an inquest. If he decided that it was, then he would summon a jury of between 12 and 23 men to help him investigate. Now, inquests happened very quickly, in this case, within just a few hours of the discovery of the body. The jury was first taken to see the body in situ, in this case, down at the house on the River Severn. And then they came back to a place just like this, in order to hear the evidence. Now imagine this room absolutely heaving with local people keen to get a look at Kitty and to hear the evidence. Now I've brought with me a copy of the Edo's Shrewsbury Journal, and it says, "The council chamber where the jury sat was thronged to excess. It must have been a terribly intimidating environment for Kitty." Many of these witnesses suggest that Kitty and her mother had a difficult relationship, and we think we know why. When Kitty was just a teenager, she was sent to work in the house of her uncle, and she became pregnant with her uncle's child. Now, it's a grim subject, but historians, with the help of family historians and the advent of DNA testing, are starting to realise that incest was much more common than we previously thought. The Edo's Shrewsbury Journal says, the bad feeling between mother and daughter appears to have first been occasioned by the daughter having, some years ago, given birth to an illegitimate child. So there we have it. Kitty, pregnant, with her uncle's child, shamed and condemned, even by her own mother. It's no wonder that there was bitterness in the relationship between them.
Oh my goodness. Poor Kitty. So she's had an illegitimate pregnancy and the father is her own uncle. Did you see that coming, Dorothy?
I didn't see the pregnancy coming, but I did wonder if she had been through abuse of some sort.
What I'm distressed by is this idea that the pregnancy was at the root of the bad feeling between them, because I think that that shows that the mother wasn't on Kitty's side when it happened.
Absolutely. And I think rather than maybe accept her role in what happened to her daughter, she decided to take the other side and make her daughter responsible for her abuse. Her mother probably felt guilty but couldn't express that, and so took the other road of vilifying and treating her daughter badly and blaming her for what happened to her.
People blame the victim because it's easier than taking any kind of responsibility for any role they may have played in what has happened.
Absolutely. And also, when you victim blame, you push away the crime from yourself. So you'd say that that would never happen to me. Why did she stay? Why didn't she do this? Why was she wearing that? Because it's easier to find fault with the victim than to think about your role in society that creates the situations where these things happen.
I can see that this really matters to you, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of my books, I do want people to understand what it's like to be a victim of a crime, and not just in the way of like it's happened to the person, but also how it fundamentally changes them.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachim.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to the story. The inquest is adjourned, but each new day brings out new evidence. The question on everyone's minds is whether Kitty really did murder her mother. Edward Edwards, Anne's brother, that's the victim's brother, now reveals a smoking gun. It's the fact that Kitty stands to inherit £200 when her mother dies and to have the interest on the remaining £300 for her life. He tells the court that he heard Kitty say these chilling words.
She has lived too long and has kept me out of my money till the hairs of my head are got grey.
Ha ha! Is this the motive we've been looking for? Did Kitty want to do away with her mother to get what she believed was rightfully hers? The medics, who are a surgeon and two GPs, now perform a post-mortem. And they agree that Anne Newton died from suffocation, suggesting that this theory is correct and that Kitty is the killer. And that would tie in with what you said, Dorothy, about the absence of screams. Suffocation could explain that. But the plot thickens because other witnesses recall seeing Anne smoking a pipe in bed. They say that Anne Newton often felt the cold and was fond of crouching so close to the fire that she had in fact set her apron on fire on several previous occasions. Two more medical men are summoned, and they say that the post-mortem evidence from the first lot of doctors cannot be relied upon. This is because the doctors performing the post-mortem failed to examine the larynx or the trachea, the breathing pipes. This might have provided vital evidence about whether Anne had inhaled smoke, which would suggest an accidental death, or if she hadn't, which would suggest foul play. Now, faced with all this conflicting evidence, the jury simply can't come to a consensus. Let's return to our guest detective, Dorothy Coombson. Dorothy, it looks like we've got a new motive here, the inheritance. Do you think somebody really could kill their own mother for the money. I mean, we've all had quarrels with our mothers, but to cross the line towards murder, that's something quite different, isn't it?
Yes, but if you're money motivated, I wouldn't put it past you to do it. Since the dawn of time, I think people have killed other people to get something that they have and they feel entitled to. But also, I'm suspicious about the person who said this because they're very much an unreliable narrator in that situation. We have one of the mother's brothers, the uncles, who has abused Kitty, and the other one, I'm not sure. He doesn't sound like he came in to rescue Kitty at any point, but now he's here with this idea that she would kill for money. I don't believe him, actually.
It could be another twist in the whole victim-blaming thing.
Absolutely.
Here's the girl who destroyed my brother's life by saying that he got her pregnant, that type of
absolutely,
line of reasoning.
Yes.
Goodness. Wow. The plot thickens. Dorothy, what are your thoughts at this point in the story? Did Kitty do it or not?
I'm leaning towards that she did, but with absolutely. Or it could have been an accident and she could have been frozen and didn't help her.
So at this point, Dorothy's verging towards thinking that Kitty is either guilty or guilty of not helping her mother. Let's find out what's going to happen next. Kitty is sent to Shrewsbury County Jail on the 16th of December, 1848. 3 months later, she goes on trial at Shrewsbury Assizes for the willful murder of her mother by suffocation and attempting to burn the body. The prosecutor tells the jury,
"The case is one at which human nature revolted at, and it is the perpetration of one of the most atrocious crimes which the most inhuman could devise, or the most diabolical carry out. It was one for which in ancient times there was found no punishment too bad or too horrible as the murder of a parent."
But Mr. Huddleston, in Kitty's defence, urges the jury not to be influenced by the slanderous gossip they might have read in the papers and to rely on the facts alone.
"The case entirely depends upon circumstantial evidence. Not one direct fact of the prisoner having been seen in connection with the murder has been proved. It is better to err on the part of mercy."
And you know what? Mr. Huddleston's completely right. There is no eyewitness evidence linking Kitty to the murder. And added to this, the medics can't even agree on the cause of death. The jury fail to reach a conclusion. Kitty's brought to trial a second time the following summer, but because of a juror being ill, they can't agree again. Back to jail she goes. And in the spring of 1850, Kitty's tried a third time. And here, she's found not guilty. Just over a year after the death of her mother, Kitty is released, scot-free. What a drama. Let's return to Roz in Bridgenorth to find out what happens next to Kitty, who, after being cleared of the charge of murder, is a free woman.
I'm at St. Mary Steps, which is a long path leading from St. Mary Magdalene Church at the top, and that's where the vicar, who was so nice to Kitty, was based, all the way down to Lowtown and the river below. And I've brought with me a copy of the census from 1851. And we can see from this document that some wealthy families lived up here at the top, and in the house beside me, a Wesleyan minister. But as we descend down these steps, it becomes a lot more humble. Several elderly people, some laundresses, and also men who are clearly working on the river. And what's really interesting about this census is that right here we find Mercy Catherine Newton, our Kitty. She's living right here, just a stone's throw from where the tragedy occurred. And she describes herself as an annuitant, which means someone in receipt of an annuity, that inheritance from her mother. And we also know that the house she is living in was given to her by Mr. Dyer in his will, her old master, who died while she was in prison. So perhaps he didn't think she was guilty either. We also know from some digging around in the records that Mercy Catherine Newton got married in 1856. So perhaps Kitty went on to live a happy life after all.
So Kitty ends up living on a pretty street in Bridgnorth with the inheritance from her mother and a property from Mr. Dyer, and potentially a nice husband too. It sounds like she's done rather well for herself. But did she do it or didn't she? I'm joined in the studio by Dorothy Coombson and Professor Rosalind Crone. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, Dorothy.
Now, Ros, tell us, we still don't know, do we, Dorothy, what Kitty meant when she said that this would be a seven-hall job.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Yes. Well, everyone's got a skeleton in their closet, but this family had this walk-in wardrobe full of skeletons. In 1823, Kitty's uncle, another uncle, not the incestuous one, John Newton, he was a farmer who lived at Seven Hall. He murdered his pregnant wife.
No.
And he was convicted and hanged for it. And it's probably also worth pointing out that there's evidence that there was conflict in the relationship between Kitty's parents as well. Not just arguments, but also some violence. So we're looking at a family here who there's a lot of trauma and a lot of really bad relationships.
My goodness. So we've got a murderous uncle, an abusive uncle, an uncaring mother.
And the other uncle as well, who is pointing the finger.
What do you think, Ros? Was she guilty or innocent? She's got motives galore, hasn't she? But did she really do it?
She does. I think that's a good question. And to be honest, I don't think we know any more than the good people of Bridgnorth. When I first came across this case, I was a PhD student. It was in the book by Judith Nelman about 19th century murderesses. And Judith Nelman presented it as this really clear-cut case. This was a daughter who'd killed her mother for the inheritance, and the evidence was just so clear. But it's been interesting to go back and revisit it. We now have much more access to sources which show a variety of perspectives on the case. And I had a chance to look at the family history this time round, you know, which revealed violence, murder, incest. And on the one hand, that might say she was more likely to do it. On the other hand, maybe she was more likely to be accused of doing it.
What's your feeling, Dorothy, guilty or innocent?
Well, I was erring towards guilty before, and I'm absolutely convinced. I do think she had motive. I believe she had reasons and probably lost control one night and decided to kill her mother.
If you were writing this story, how would you have ended it?
I would have ended it with having the daughter, Kitty's daughter, illegitimate daughter, killing her grandmother and then going off to London to live her life as revenge for what happened to her mother.
Ooh.
That would be an interesting twist, wouldn't it?
Isn't it strange inside a novelist's head?
Absolutely.
It is, absolutely, yes.
Well, at the outset, this looked like a clear-cut case of a murderous daughter. But the deeper we've delved, the more dark secrets we've found. Kitty started out looking like the perpetrator, but we've ended up thinking of her more as a victim. I think it's likely that the deep trauma in the Newton family, unresolved, found a terrible outlet on that stormy December night. What I take away from this story is that if there are secrets in your family, do discuss them, don't let them fester, and do, above all, try not to have three very bad uncles. A big thank you to Dorothy Coombson and Professor Rosalind Crone, along with Bridgnorth Town Hall. Next time, I'm joined by podcaster Hannah Maguire of Red Handed to talk murder, media and mania, and to ask, is true crime a modern obsession? Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley from BBC Radio 4 is produced by Emily Hughes, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble, Ruth Sillers and Bill Hope. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. See you next time.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachim.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.